The Robber Barons, The Rise of the Trust. Now, as I said last time, the first trust was brought forward by Samuel C.T. Dodd, the Council of Standard Oil. In 1882, in a secret agreement, all the existing 37 stockholders in the diverse oil industry of refining, piping, buying and or selling oil conveyed their shares of stock in trust to 9 trustees, which again, I have mentioned before, John and William Rockefeller, O.H. Payne, Charles Pratt, Henry Flagler, John Archibald, W.G. Warden, Jabez Bostwick, and Benjamin Brewster. The stockholders then were given trust certificates in denomination of $100 in return for the shares that they had deposited. The trustees, controlling 2/3 of all the shares, became the direct stockholders of all the companies in the system. Further, the trustees were empowered to serve as directors of all the firms and held in their hands final control of all the properties. They could dissolve any corporation within the system. They could reorganize any of them and make new ones. In each state, for example, you'd have a Standard Oil of New Jersey, Standard Oil of New York. There were no outsiders and no newly arrived stockholders that had any voice in the affairs of the various companies. The trustees formed an almost supreme council, giving a centralized direction to their industry. So began the evolution of the management of huge amounts of combined capital. Dodd, the resourceful philosopher of monopoly, defended his legal structure of the Standard Oil Trust, both in a pamphlet he printed in 1888 and in an argument before a congressional committee in 1888. Dodd claimed it was created out of a crying need for centralized control of the oil business due to the disastrous conditions resulting from problems of cooperation and associations among various refiners, shipping and producing different products. The Standard Oil Trust enabled refiners to cooperate, which reduced petroleum costs and which ultimately benefited the public. Well, at least for a while. The trust pointed the way to future organization of all industry and would abolish what is known as ruinous competition. From the Standard Oil headquarters on 140th Pearl Street, the Supreme Council of their economic empire worked. There they received confidential news from agents and informers from all over the world and then would discuss it. They would then come up with business policies. That's how they determined them. In addition, the group skillfully was divided into committees. There's a marketing committee, transportation committee, and so forth. These new processes, new markets and developments worldwide in everyone's business were followed and acted on. Every day the group lunched with John D. Rockefeller in the headquarters on Pearl Street, and later in a large famous office building simply known as 26th Broadway. No one questioned John D. Rockefeller's preeminence, though Charles Pratt usually sat at the head of the table. Now, Archibald was the member closest to John D. Rockefeller. Brother William Rockefeller, while rich and well-trained in the use of money, depended heavily on Henry Rogers. Rogers, as the years passed by, took to a more dominant role in the management of the company. These men, alone with their trustee, with the other trustees, were the leaders who carried on their industrial operation like a band of conspiratorial revolutionists. As Ida Tarbell said, quote, "There was not a lazy bone nor stupid head in the bunch," end of quote. Behind the trustees were active captains, lieutenants, followers, workers, everybody all laboring with the pride, the loyalty, discipline, and enthusiasm born of the knowledge that they can do no better for themselves than working for and under Standard Oil, which is, you know, corporate loyalty. You have people who worked for IBM, worked for other corporations. You know, they would give anything for the corporation. They assume it would take care of them. Now, at this point, once they construct it, this is the trust now goes to work. They began looking through what they owned and scrapped unprofitable plants. They would then acquire others, build new ones. They found ways of effecting enormous economies, and always their profits mounted into unbelievably grotesque figures. In 1879, invested capital of $3.5 million brought dividends for that year of $3,150,000. It was paid out in the values that they had. Standard Oil in 1879 was estimated to be worth $55 million. Profits were usually reinvested in new capital goods, and with the formation of the trust, capitalization was set at $70 million. By 1886, net earnings had risen to $15 million a year. The slogan of the trustees of Standard Oil, quote, "Hide the profits and say nothing," end of quote. The public did see prices drop, but after 1875, and even more so after 1881, a firm price was set and then maintained from 1881 to 1891. Services for gathering and transporting oil weren't lowered for 20 years, despite technological advances made by Standard Oil. When Rogers was questioned about his business and the amount of money they were making, he has this famous quote, and you've probably heard this, quote, "We are not in the business for our health, but are out for the dollar," end of quote. Monopoly policy usually avoided maximum profits because at that level it invited competition, but it was directed to keep profit margins stable during a rising trend in consumption and a falling curve in production costs. So if people are buying more, you can raise your prices a little bit, and then you become more efficient as a result of what you're doing. You're still making more profit, but it doesn't seem that way. The cost is the same or just a little higher, but you can make it work. Now, one of the interesting things is usually technical improvements were delayed, sometimes a decade or more, until the commercial value was proven beyond the shadow of a doubt. So they're making lots of money as it is. There's not any real need to do much technological improvement unless you get a little bit more competition. And generally speaking, it was only after rivals to Standard Oil in desperation began doing new things that Standard Oil would then make the change. And one of the first things that happened is the rivals of Standard Oil contrived to pumping oil in a 200-mile-long pipeline. Well, Rockefeller immediately put one in and did the same thing. This was true of various developments where new byproducts or even the introduction of better tank cars languished until it was more appropriate. John D. Rockefeller said that he wanted in his organization, quote, "only the big ones, those who have already proved they can do a big business. As for the others, unfortunately, they will have to die," end of quote. So the trusts are beginning. We'll be seeing more of the trusts as we go along. But having been successful with Standard Oil, it's time to move on to other people. So we're going to head next time to J.P. Morgan and his railroads. Now the sources for this are The Robber Barons by Matthew Josephson, America and the Gilded Age by Cashman, The Age of Moguls, The Story of Robber Barons and Tycoons by Holbrook. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.